From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Hillary Clinton and the price of inevitability. Hello again, I'm Oren Almy, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In the mainstream media, it's now conventional wisdom that Hillary Rodham Clinton is the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee. The current narrative is she's overcome years of personal scrutiny and that voters are warming to her unexpectedly. But as her lead grows in fundraising and Democratic public opinion polls, some Republicans are rubbing their hands. On To the Point, with the Iowa caucuses still 3 months away, does being the acknowledged front-runner create a new set of vulnerabilities? Have those old negative images been erased forever? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the U.S. Supreme Court turns down a case of extraordinary rendition. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Hillary Rodham Clinton is now the acknowledged front-runner on the Democratic side. On To the Point, we'll hear how that creates its own set of problems. Why are Republicans rubbing their hands? On Reporter's Notebook, the U.S. Supreme Court refuses to hear claims of CIA kidnapping and torture. We'll hear why. First, this news update. In the past 3 days, 15 Turkish troops have been ambushed and killed near the Iraq border, reportedly by the PKK, a Kurdish separatist group. Today, Turkey's government said it has started to plan a military operation into Iraq to chase after the PKK. Semih Adis is columnist for Milliyet, one of Turkey's major newspapers. Semih Adis, good to have you back on our program.
Good evening from Ankara.
I understand that on television, the news anchors have been reading out the names of the soldiers that were killed by the PKK. Pictures of their families clutching photographs of the men involved have been shown as well. What kind of pressure does that put on the government?
Well, the public pressure is immense, of course, and the government is having to respond to this because this attack comes only about a week after another attack last week in which 12 civilians were gunned down this time. So there's a great pressure building up on the government to act. But, of course, what the government can exactly do is open to question. Today, the Supreme Board that coordinates the fight against terrorism and is headed by the government decided to opt for every option possible to combat this. And that includes the military option and the option of hot pursuit into northern Iraq to get at the bases of these groups of the PKK. So everything is on the table, but it doesn't seem that there's anything imminent because whatever the pressure from the public may be, there are still some factors that impose a little more restraint on the government.
Well, one of those presumably would be the United States, which, as I understand it, is arguing that that northern part of Iraq, where that part of Kurdistan, is the most secure part of the country, and they don't want to see any action up there.
Well, precisely, but part of the public outcry in Turkey is to go this be in spite of the United States, because it's supposed to be an ally, it's supposed to be the predominant power in Iraq, and yet the public perception in Turkey is that America is doing nothing to help weed out the PKK in northern Iraq, and that is where these guys are holding, and that's where they're operating from, with a certain amount of sheltering and protecting by the Iraqi Kurdish leadership. At least that's the way it is seen on this end. So America's request would not really be the final determinant here. It would be more a question of military and civilian planners wondering what Turkey might be actually entering into if it did go in, because there are, of course, quite a few uncertainties associated with the whole idea.
Well, isn't one of those that although there are certainly PKK bases in northern Iraq, most of the PKK is actually in Turkey?
Well, yes, but their logistic bases have moved into the haven of northern Iraq, where they enjoy also the benefit of being able to use, say, for example, the hospitals in Süleymaniye and Erbil and other facilities, and they don't have to be on their sort of guard all the time in terms of security. So, you know, in many ways, the leadership and the operational elements, at least the command centers, have moved into northern Iraq, into the Kandil Mountain region, which also houses this other group called Tejak, which is a PKK-inspired group, but which operates within Iran this time. So that is the way it really is stacked up here, and the public just, you know, despite the uncertainties that may face the government and the military, the government on the political dimension, because there's going to be some international reaction, and the military in terms of the uncertainty of what it might find if it went in. But in spite of that, there is a tangible pressure on the government by the public to do something.
The Kurdish Iraqis are saying that there is no political or administrative link with the PKK. What evidence is there that PKK soldiers are able to use hospitals, as you just said, in Salamania and Kurbil?
Well, this has been reported in the media, both in the foreign and the local media, and Erbil is not that great a place. I have been there a few times myself, so and the facilities that are available and the places that you go to are not large in terms of numbers. So, you know, when a representative or somebody from this group comes, they are noticed, of course, and I'm sure that as with the spotters of various countries, Turkish spotters are there also.
So the bottom line then is that the pressures are great on the Turkish government. You don't expect anything to happen, however, very soon.
Well, no, I think that reason will prevail. But on the other hand, I mean, if these attacks continue and the pressure becomes quite unbearable, well, you know, America after September 11 is a good example of how public pressure can force governments into situations that may turn out to be more complicated than they initially assumed. So, you know, the Turks would have to think very, very carefully. The Turkish side would have to think very carefully before doing this.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. Sami Adiz, again, a columnist for Milliyet in Ankara. In a moment, Hillary Clinton and the price of inevitability on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point. In Iowa, Hillary Rodham Clinton has begun a bus tour she calls the Middle Class Express to tell voters she cares about hardworking Americans. Meantime, conventional wisdom has shifted in her direction. The Boston Globe reports that New Hampshire voters are warming unexpectedly to Clinton. She is leading in the latest Iowa poll. Today's New York Times calls her the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee. Mark Halperin is senior political analyst and editor-at-large at Time magazine. Mark, good to have you on our program.
Happy to be here.
Your headline says Clinton takes a shaky lead in Iowa. What's shaky about it?
Well, the poll has a margin of error, like all polls do, and it's very difficult to poll in caucuses generally. As you know, not very many people participate, around 100,000 probably, maybe a bit more. And it's hard to know who's actually going to turn out. In addition, we've seen a couple of changes, one change definite and one attempted change that could change the makeup of the electorate. And any poll is only as good as the modeling that's done about it. If you're polling the right people. The caucuses are probably going to be January 3rd or January 5th. That's much earlier than usual. That could affect who turns out. And Senator Obama in particular is making an effort to bring younger people in, even going so far as to recruit high school students who will be old enough to vote for president in 2008. So it's difficult to know whether they're polling the right people. Finally, Iowa is a tough state for Senator Clinton, in part because Senator Obama and Senator Edwards are so strong there. And she may not be at her absolute ceiling, but even some of her supporters say she's unlikely to get very many more votes in terms of a percentage than she has now. So all that adds up to a lead probably, but not a very safe one or a very big one compared to her advantages elsewhere.
It's a lead of what does she have relative to the other candidates now in the Iowa poll?
5 or 6 point lead. She's in the high 20s, about 28, and Obama and Edwards in the low 20s.
But that, of course, I was just going to say, that's not even a third of the vote. So a lot of Democrats, at this point at least, have not swung in her direction.
That's right. And again, just as she has a ceiling nationally, she probably has a ceiling in Iowa. So I think she thinks she can win this with around 30, 33, 34% of the vote. But that does not leave you much margin of error. Now, there are other candidates running, of course, besides the big three, but the rules of the caucuses in terms of how they actually function generally get people towards the major candidates. If you don't get a certain threshold level of support, you're asked to vote for someone else. And I think most of those votes would go to Obama, Clinton, and Edwards.
What about the question of expectations? And once you've been declared the presumptive front runner, what problem does that create in itself?
Well, it's a big problem because whether it's fair or not, and whether it's the way we should go about picking our presidents, expectations matter a lot. One Democrat not working for Senator Clinton told me this week, he doesn't support her candidacy, said he was delighted that she had gone ahead in this poll. Because now, if she loses Iowa, or even if she doesn't wins but by a very narrow margin, that win will be discounted. And if she loses, it will be a huger victory, an even bigger victory for Senator Obama or Senator Edwards if they knocked her off. So it's nice for her that she shows progress. The poll, I think, is solid enough in terms of its sample to suggest that she has made progress, and the other campaigns agree with that. But it's not nice for her in the sense that it does raise expectations, and it does make it make her position there precarious if she loses. In the end, what matters is if she wins or not. And that's what she's really focused on, because Iowa has become the center of attention in this Democratic race.
Mark Halperin with Time Magazine, author of The Undecided Voter's Guide to the Next President, which is going to be released next week. Andrew Sullivan's our next guest. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. His blog, The Daily Dish, can be found on the magazine's website. He, too, has a book out, The Conservative Soul, published last year, out in paperback just today. Andrew Sullivan, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Has there been, do you think, an exaggeration of Hillary Clinton's lead and what's referred to in many cases as her inevitability?
Yes, I do, in a word. And I certainly think at this point in time in October, I know we've gotten so far ahead of ourselves with this electoral cycle, but I think it's a little nuts to actually think of someone as having a lock or inevitability on the nomination. And if I were an Iowan or someone in New Hampshire, the whole point of Iowa and New Hampshire is to tell people in Washington and the media who is and who is not the front runner. I think it's dangerous for her to be this assumed to be this far ahead at this point in the game.
Dangerous in the same ways that Mark Halperin just described, because of the expectations that creates?
Yes. I mean, remember her husband in New Hampshire. He lost New Hampshire, but he came a good second. And it was coming the good second that got him the comeback kid back in 1992. And enabled him to leverage that into a victory. I think that with Obama especially, when you have another campaign with more money than she does, then you know this other person has the stamina to get through the first the hurdles. And if she has any trip up now in the first month or so, it's going to look bad for her.
I should update our listeners. It has just been reported today that four of the Democratic candidates have removed their names from the January 15th Michigan presidential primary. The idea is that Michigan jumped the gun, came too early. That's not when the party wants it to hold its primary. So Obama, Edwards, Biden, and Richardson are out of that. Mark Halperin, let me go back to you with Time Magazine. Is Hillary Clinton going to get out of there, too?
I think that she will. Like her normal cautious self, the deadline's not until the end of the day, and the Clintons like to take all the time they have before making a decision. I think it would be too dangerous for her to stay on the ballot. The upside would be that she might get some delegates or some momentum out of a Michigan win, even if there were no delegates assigned for the victory by the Democratic Party. The downside risk, though, is in Iowa, and because Iowa and the winning of Iowa has become so imperative to the expected narrative on the Democratic side, I suspect she will join them and ask that her name not be included.
You were pretty careful about the way that you described her lead. Do you agree with Andrew Sullivan that it has been exaggerated in some circles? And what about those negatives that have been haunting her for so many years?
There's no question it's been exaggerated. That's unfortunately the nature of our media. The trajectory tends to be tripled or quadrupled. She is a solid frontrunner, and there's no doubt that she is the most likely Democratic nominee and, I believe, the most likely next president. But Senator Obama and Senator Edwards are still in a position to take this nomination away from her, perhaps some of the others if they really up their performance in the next few weeks. But it is mostly about Iowa. Her negatives are a big problem. Her negatives make people curious about Democrats worried about whether she could win a general election, whether she could be a unifying figure as president. I suspect if you read this morning's Boston Globe story about how some New Hampshire voters are taking a second look at her, you'll see what at least the Clinton people hope happens, which is enough people in the nomination fight, and then if she's the nominee in the general election, are willing to think anew about her and think bad things about her opponents in such a way that she disqualifies them, which she's doing very skillfully with Senator Obama so far, that they turn to her, even if it's not by acclamation.
Okay, we're going to be talking with somebody in New Hampshire a little bit later on our program. First, back to Andrew Sullivan. You have questioned whether or not Hillary Clinton really has the, excuse me, not whether or not, you have questioned the credentials of Hillary Clinton as president of the United States.
Well, I've just said that this notion that she has enormous experience in government is a little dubious, given the fact that she was, in fact, just the wife of a president for 8 years. And we seem to be slipping a little bit in America towards a sort of South Asian or Argentina model in which first ladies become the inheritor of their husband's political dynasty. This is something that America hasn't seen before. It's something that you saw, for example, in Sri Lanka or the Philippines or India. It's not something that one associates with a meritocratic democracy like the United States. I also think that the more she's ahead, the more people remember her in power when she was in the White House for 8 years. And that means that she becomes less an agent for change than an agent to go back to an old particular structure. And in a country which wants change, that makes her more of an incumbent in some ways than a change agent. And that's the danger if she becomes understood to be the prohibitive front runner. All the problems of incumbency begin to accrue to her. And Obama and Edwards still have the potential to be the people that say we're really going to change the country.
You say that we're using the Argentina model. She certainly has experience of her own in the Senate. She's in her second term.
Yes, she has. And that, of course, distinguishes her distinctly. It does make the difference. However, the feel of it, I mean, it's unconscionable in a European country that the wife of a former prime minister would subsequently become prime minister. I think it's unthinkable in Britain, for example, unthinkable in France, unthinkable in other countries where the notion of dynasty in executive power is just simply absent.
Andrew Sullivan, again, a senior editor at The Atlantic, a blogger, The Daily Dish, author of Conservative Soul. Kim Gandy is president of the National Organization for Women. Kim Gandy, welcome to you.
I'm glad to be aboard.
What do you say about Hillary Clinton and the Argentina, Sri Lanka, Philippines model of succession?
Well, I'm not sure what a model of succession it is, but it's very clear that Hillary Clinton has not only 8 years' experience in the White House, but she has long experience as a public figure and, of course, is in her second term in the U.S. Senate, which, entirely aside from her time in the White House, gives her more experience than any of the Democratic frontrunners. And, of course, her stature around the world contributes enormously to her attractiveness. I just returned from a World Women's Conference in South Korea, where women all over the world were asking me about Hillary Clinton. I mean, she has enormous stature all around the world, and would work an immediate change in the way the rest of the world sees this country. Something that Obama and Edwards, Richardson, fine candidates, but they're not known in the same way. They would have to earn the trust of the world, and Hillary Clinton has it already.
What about Andrew Sullivan's point that the more and the longer that she's ahead, the more people tend to remember the way things were when she was in the White House, and the possibility that we'll be back engaged in old debates that we just as soon get past?
Well, you know, I think that most people, who, especially having been through 6 years of George Bush, look back on the years of Bill Clinton's presidency with some considerable fondness. And I don't think that there is any sense that there's been any less partisan rancor or partisanship during these 6 years than there were during those 8 years. In fact, I think people feel fairly positively about how we did under the Clintons. So I don't think that hurts Hillary Clinton. At the same time, Hillary Clinton is not Bill Clinton. She is her own person. She's been very clear about that. She has her own experience, her own priorities, and would be her own president.
Andrew Sullivan, back to you. What do you mean when we say that, or when you say, rather, that people will remember the debates and disputes of the past? Is it the kind of partisanship that Ken Gandhi just referred to, or something else?
I think it's the whole people have become much fonder of Clinton the longer they have gotten away from that particular period. And I think Clinton was also much more popular because of his enemies as much as his substantive identity as a politician. But it seems to me you can't have it both ways. If Hillary is her own person, then what job did she have in the White House for 8 years? And what job was she elected for 8 years? And in what ways is therefore she an independent figure? If you claim she had experience in government, then you must assume that she basically got that power through her marriage, which is not, I might add, a great advertisement for feminism. It's actually a throwback from feminism. And if so you can't say she has experience and yet she's not also her story isn't a function really of her marriage. I understand that she has gotten elected on her own ground, and she's certainly run a campaign that I think has been superb so far. She's a very intelligent person and a very capable public figure. However, it is a little retro to go back in past, especially to a polarizing past, where you know that a large number of people in this country just cannot contemplate her as president again. They think of her as co-president for 8 years. They think of her going to be co-president again for 8 years. And that resistance to that memory is real. It's there. It's affecting a lot of people. And if the Democrats don't want to deal with that problem, they have other options, and they may pick them.
Kim Gandhi, you're the president of the National Organization for Women, a throwback from feminism. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, Andrew's certainly doing his job, which is to provoke debate, but he says one thing 1 minute and a different thing the very next day. He says, what office has she held for 8 years? The answer is United States Senator. She's been a United States Senator for 8 years. On the one hand, he says, well, what did she do in the White House? Nothing. And then he turns around and says half the country thinks that she was co-president with Clinton. Well, was she co-president or did she do nothing at all? Is it a throwback to feminism that a very powerful man chooses someone who is every bit as accomplished and good at the job as he is, to the extent that he would say to the country, you get two for one, she's just as smart and just as good at this as I am? I think that that's a tribute to feminism, that powerful men have powerful, smart, accomplished women as partners.
Kim Gandhi, again, with the National Organization for Women. Quickly, Andrew Sullivan, before we need to go to a break, your response?
If it was two for one in the 90s, why isn't it two for one today? And that question of her marriage and power, it revives itself at this point in time. What position will Bill Clinton have if he doesn't have an official position as she didn't in the first administration? What would his real position be? We're electing people whom we're not actually electing. We had Hillary for 8 years as co-president. We're going to have Bill potentially as co-president for 8 years, and yet we won't have him on the ballot.
Okay, we're going to have to take a break, as I indicated. Hopefully our guests will stay with it. I'm not sure all of them can, but we'll get as many as we can. We have people in Iowa and New Hampshire as well to talk with. On Reporter's Notebook, the U.S. Supreme Court turns down a case of extraordinary rendition. We'll hear about that in a moment on To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, talking about Hillary Rodham Clinton, Kim Gandhi with the National Organization for Women. Andrew Sullivan just said if it was two for one when Bill Clinton was president, what's it going to be if Hillary Clinton is president? What's his job going to be?
You know, it's interesting that he goes back and forth. He starts out with she didn't do anything in the White House. After all, she was not elected, and then he switches around. So I think that he's going to say whatever. Obviously, we know that he supports Mr. Obama, so he's going to say whatever benefits him there. But the reality is that if you look at what's going on the right-wing talk shows, conservative talk radio, Rush Limbaugh, O'Reilly, et cetera, the Republicans and the conservatives do not want Hillary Clinton to be the nominee. And clearly that's because she's going to be the hardest one for them to beat. That's why they attack her constantly. You don't see the conservative attack machine going after the other Democrats the way they go after Hillary. And that's because they know that she's the toughest opponent. And that may be the only message that Democrats need to see.
What about Bill Clinton?
She's the one hardest to beat.
What about Bill Clinton's job?
Oh, Bill Clinton's going to be first mate.
And is that two for one? Will he be a policymaker and involved as she allegedly was in the White House when he was president?
I have no doubt in my mind that just the way my husband tells me what he thinks about the things that I do, and I, you know, listen to his advice, and I may or may not take it. It may or may not agree with what I've decided to do. I am certain that Bill Clinton will tell Hillary Clinton what he thinks about what she's doing, and she'll take it or not. I imagine that was their relationship when he was the president.
Andrew Sullivan, back to you, senior editor at The Atlantic. What about it? The right-wing talk shows, are they indicating that the Republicans don't want to run against Hillary? She'll be the hardest to beat?
She's their dream candidate for a very simple reason, which is that she's immensely good for their fundraising. You can see even National Review the whole week ran a fundraising drive, help us stop Hillary. You see billboards everywhere, help us stop Hillary. The one major, and Hillary herself, Clinton herself has conceded that she is a major fundraiser for the religious right. That movement is now fractured and disintegrating. Hillary Clinton is the one person who can galvanize it, unite it, and bring its funding back. That's why they want her to be, and that's why places like the Drudge Report or Fox News are so obsessed with her, because they know that she's great business for them.
Still with us, Mark Halperin, senior political analyst, editor-at-large at Time magazine. It's a very interesting conversation about Hillary Clinton. It's night and day.
She cannot win a referendum up or down. Would you like her to be president? She has too many enemies. But George Bush could not win a referendum up or down in 2004. Would you like George Bush to be reelected? What George Bush did, which Hillary Clinton has studied, is to not make it a referendum on the incumbent or the quasi-incumbent, but a choice election. And I think that if she is the nominee, she will very skillfully and aggressively try to define whoever the Republicans nominate as unacceptable. She can't win by a lot, but no Democrat can win by a lot. Just there's too many parts of the country that won't vote for whoever the Democrat is. She has proven that she can win people over in New York and in the Senate. That's not the same as winning people over around the country. But in this divided country, she basically needs to win all the states John Kerry did, plus a couple others. And I think she can do that. And as I said before, despite all the excellent points that Andrew made, despite all the problems she brings to this candidacy, I think she's the most likely next president.
Andrew Sullivan, your response?
I think she is the likeliest, too. I just think that the United States can do better than going back to its past. I think there are other options in front of the United States than the wife of a former president.
And Kim Gandy, a quick response, final comment from you.
I think that Hillary Clinton on election would immediately restore the standing of this country in the rest of the world and would be a great president.
Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women, Andrew Sullivan with The Atlantic, his blog, The Daily Dish, his book, The Conservative Soul, out in paperback today. Mark Halperin, senior political analyst, editor-at-large of Time magazine. His book, The Undecided Voter's Guide to the Next President, is going to be released next week. Good to have all of you with us, and come back again soon.
Well,
thank you.
As promised, we have people in Iowa and people in New Hampshire, or one in each state, to tell us how things are going there. Iowa, which we've already discussed at some length, where the caucuses are. We heard a little bit earlier from Mark Halperin about how they work, how difficult it is to poll, because you really don't know who's going to turn out to the caucuses on a very cold winter night in Iowa. Peverell Squire is political science professor at the University of Iowa. Peverell Squire, excuse me, mispronounced your name. I'm sorry for that. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
The latest poll by the Des Moines Register. What about it? What does it tell us? What does it not tell us?
Well, it tells us a little bit of what we think is happening on the ground here in Iowa. It has Clinton ahead on the Democratic side and Romney holding to a lead on the Republican side. But as you noted earlier, it is difficult to survey potential caucus goers because nobody's quite sure who's going to show up on caucus day or night, whenever it's going to be. We haven't got a date set yet, so it's really hard to predict who's going to show up. But most of the surveys we've taken are pointing in the same direction. So we think we probably have a reasonably good handle on what the race looks like today.
Does it appear that Iowa voters, those who go to the caucuses, are going because they are committed to a given candidate because of that person's virtues? Or are they looking for somebody who can win the Democratic nomination and win the election?
Well, I think both Republicans and Democrats are going to be mobilized by the idea of trying to take the White House. And I think electability is going to be paramount in both parties. And so I think the candidates are probably enjoying more or less success based on how well voters think they can do in the general election. So I think in the case of Senator Clinton, she's been able to convince a lot of Democrats that she can win in November. And because of that, she's managed to come from behind here in Iowa and pull out to what appears to be a lead.
How has she done that, given the fact that for so long she was found to be by polls, I believe, including the poll at the Des Moines Register, that she was too polarizing, that as Mark Halperin just said, she can't win an up or down a vote. How has she overcome those things, and does it have anything to do with the kind of retail politics that goes on in the state of Iowa?
I think it has a lot to do with face-to-face meetings. I think that Clinton has put time into the state, and because she's been here, people have been able to see her in person rather than learning about her being filtered through the news media. And I think she's made a pretty good impression while she's been here. She's managed this sort of retail politics pretty well. And because of that, she has been able to position herself as being somebody who's not as threatening as people may have feared. I think one of the great things of having this crowded field is that Senator Clinton clearly is not on the liberal end of the Democratic spectrum right now. And that allows her to play to the middle. And a lot of Democrats can look at that and see a candidate who might be able to take that middle ground during the general election and win.
Peverell Square, a professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Jennifer Donahue is a senior advisor to the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm's College. Jennifer Donahue, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Article today in the Boston Globe from Concord, New Hampshire. The headline is, "Many Warming Unexpectedly to Clinton." They quote somebody who describes himself as a superdeniac progressive type who says, to his astonishment, he is finding that other Democrats who feel as he did, despite the fact that Hillary Clinton's moving away from the liberal positions that she has held in the past, that they are, in fact, in favor of her anyway. What's your take?
Well, I think it's a little more fluid than that. That sounds sort of anecdotal. It may represent where some people are going. And I did go to an Obama event today, and I am going to a Hillary Clinton event tomorrow. They're absolutely descending on the state this week. So it must be a little slower in Iowa. Last week we were a little slower, so I suspect Iowa was busier. But I think, truthfully, it's too early to poll. And to use anecdotes, you have to make sure you use enough of them and get enough people. There are some Dean people that are going towards Hillary. There are some independents going towards her. But Obama has a message and a base, and he consistently gets good turnout at his events. He's polling lower than Hillary Clinton here, and yet what we're finding most consistently in New Hampshire polls is that only about 17% of Democrats have made a firm decision, which suggests to me that probably Democrats are waiting to figure out who the most electable is, and they're looking to see how they perform this fall.
And on the issue of anecdotes as opposed to polls, scientific or otherwise, the gentleman who refers to himself as a superdeniac turns out to be now functioning with the Clinton campaign. So one takes with these things with a grain of salt. So only 17% are really firm in their decisions, and of those who are firm, is Hillary Clinton still in the lead?
She is in the lead among those who are firm. She's about 20 to 23 points up from Obama in a poll that was taken a few weeks ago. But the reality, I think, is that they have continued to be each other's main opponent. And I wouldn't say that Edwards has risen to the level here that he appears to have done in Iowa. He's running a ground game here. He's got an operation. He sends Elizabeth Edwards a lot as a surrogate. But to keep top hold on Iowa, he can't really put the time into New Hampshire that he'd probably like to. So here it's more of a two-man race right now for first position. And the numbers, I think, don't reflect right now how competitive it is, but they reflected it before when Obama was leading Clinton. So, you know, in New Hampshire, a lot of people do decide late. That's one of the trademarks of New Hampshire voters, and especially independents who make up 44% of the electorate here. So I think realistically, it's going to take a while for this to settle and become clear.
Can independents in New Hampshire vote in either the Democratic or the Republican primaries?
Indeed they can. So that makes them not only late voters and hard-to-read voters, but real swing voters, because they can walk in on Election Day and ask for a Republican or a Democratic Party ballot and vote that way, and then reassign themselves as undeclared before they leave the voting station. So they're really a mysterious vote, but they are the margin of a win or a loss for a candidate in New Hampshire, and they're the ones who make New Hampshire so unpredictable.
Jennifer Donahue, a senior advisor to the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm's College. Peverell Squire, back to you at the University of Iowa. Is there an independent mystery vote in Iowa as there is in New Hampshire?
Very little. The Iowa caucuses require you to be a member of the party to participate, although you can come into the caucus and register there, and you can even change your registration if you decide one party is more interesting than the other. So it's not a case where you'll have a large influx of independents. These are people who will have to commit themselves at least for that day to register as a Republican or a Democrat to participate.
What about Edwards in Iowa, and how is it that he's been able to maintain such a strong position there when he hasn't been in New Hampshire?
Well, he's invested an awful lot of time and effort in Iowa, and he had the residuals of an organization in place from his efforts back in 2004. And if you recall, he made a very favorable impression in Iowa back in the 2004 caucuses. He finished a close second behind Senator Kerry, and there was a lot of goodwill. He'd made a very favorable impression, and he's been able to build on that. So by putting a lot of time and effort into a place where he already had a base in place, he's managed to probably do better here than probably any place else in the country.
So how then, we haven't really talked about Obama in Iowa, how do the top three fare versus one another?
They're actually all in good shape at this point. They all have very good organizations in place, which is important because of the nature of the caucuses. You do need to mobilize voters. You do need to be able to help people get to their caucuses and remind them to turn out. And so I think all three of the top Democratic candidates are well positioned in terms of their organizations. It's just a matter now of Iowa Democrats evaluating them, and I think once again they'll try to figure out which candidate would do the best in November.
As we said earlier, there's now a flap about what's happening in Michigan, where the Democrats in that state tried to move their primary forward into January. Now four of the candidates, Obama, Edwards, Biden, and Richardson have said they're going to pull out of that. Professor Squire, is the caucus going to occur, or are the caucuses going to occur in Iowa?
Well, we don't know is the honest answer. Right now, they're still scheduled for January 14th, but because of all this sort of game of leapfrog that the various states are playing, it is likely that New Hampshire will move up, and because New Hampshire moves up, Iowa will then try to be in front of New Hampshire. So probably the best guess at this point is either January 3rd or January 5th, and it's probably more likely to be the 3rd.
There was at one time a rumor that it might even occur in December. Is there any likelihood of that at all?
Well, it could still happen, but I think there would be a terrific reluctance in the state to do anything that would sort of intervene in the holiday season. So I think Iowans will probably try to make their last-ditch effort drawing the line in very early January.
Jennifer Donahue, what about New Hampshire? Is it going to try to get ahead of Iowa?
Well, the other mystery in New Hampshire is going to be when our Secretary of State sets the primary, because it really has come under a much more competitive scrutiny from the other states this time. And he has the ability, Bill Gardner, the Secretary of State here, to set the date very late in the cycle because it's a small state and you can print out even two sets of ballots with different days on them if you had to. Right now it looks like it could be January 8th if Iowa were to go, especially on January 3rd. If Iowa chooses January 5th, I don't know, because then there's only 3 days in between the two, and I don't know if Bill Gardner will think that's enough time in between the two. Our law only requires us to go 7 or more days before a similar event, which would be a primary, like Michigan. So the 8th would secure the state from that. But there's also the aspect of wanting to protect that week in between New Hampshire and Iowa, or at least as much of a week as possible. So we'll just, I guess, have to wait and see.
Do you think there's a sort of turnoff factor for voters when states engage in what might seem to some a sort of unseemly battle to see who's going to go first?
I think it probably does have that effect in other states. Here, they're pretty used to it because it's happened before. In 96, Delaware jumped ahead of New Hampshire. In that case, Gardner allowed it to happen. It was a caucus, I believe, and it didn't appear to be a very big deal. There have been other cases, and Michigan has tried to leapfrog New Hampshire before. So, you know, it's just so many front-loaded efforts at once. And I think the greater concern here is not so much New Hampshire itself, but what would a totally front-loaded process do to lesser-known candidates or the candidates with less money? Because New Hampshire traditionally does sometimes give a chance to people who are underfunded, like McCain in 2000. And it's going to be hard for an underfunded candidate to get through Iowa, New Hampshire, and anywhere else if they haven't scored a victory. So if New Hampshire, for example, were to be 3 days after Iowa and the bounce were lessened, or the New Hampshire vote were different from Iowa, you could see it being a pretty tough landing on February 5th without a lot of cash.
Professor Squire, in Iowa, when the election officials are thinking about what date they're going to hold their events, caucuses or primaries, are they concerned about that? That the if in fact Iowa is too soon before New Hampshire, it might really have a devastating effect on some candidacies.
Well, I think they're trying to maintain some distance between the two events. In the last several election cycles, it's always been 8 days, and this time around, it could be possibly 5 or even 3 days, which would, of course, provide the candidates almost no recovery time, and we're not sure exactly what the dynamics would be, but Iowa's results might sweep through the rest of the process. But there is another concern, sort of a very logistic, mechanical concern for Iowans. You have to secure about 1,800 different locations to hold these caucuses, and of course the caucuses on the Democratic side can take several hours. And so right now trying to figure out what day these are going to be held is critical so that they can try to find enough places in all these precincts around the state to hold these events.
Find out whether the high school auditorium is available on the right night and all the other kinds of places
exactly
where they hold the caucuses in Iowa. Well, thanks very much to both of you for being with us. Peverill Squire, once again, political science professor, University of Iowa, and Jennifer Donahue, senior advisor to the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College in the state of New Hampshire. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
The case of Khaled al-Masri is the most extensively documented case of what's called extraordinary rendition. The CIA is accused of seizing terrorists and transporting them, or suspected terrorists, I should say, and transporting them to countries known to use torture in their interrogations. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear what is regarded, once again, as the most extensively documented such case. We'll hear more about that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Werman Olney back with Purporter's Notebook on To the Point. When it refused to take the case of Khaled al-Masri, the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said, "We recognize the gravity of our conclusions." Justices explained that the case pits the judiciary's search for truth against the executive's duty to maintain the nation's security. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court turned down al-Masri's appeal. Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate.com, the internet magazine. She's also a contributor to NPR's Day to Day program. Dahlia Lithwick, as always, good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Now, this was a case which involved mistaken identity. How does it rise to the level of one where the executive's duty to maintain the nation's security is involved?
Well, that is a good question. You know, the facts, Warren, are really awful in this case. We have, Khaled al-Masri, who is mistaken, for Khalid al-Masri, someone involved in the 9/11 attacks. He's grabbed on New Year's Eve in 2003. He's on vacation in Macedonia. Al-Masri is a German citizen, 44 years old, father of four. And he's just seized by the Macedonian police, immediately strip searched, beaten, chained, dressed in a diaper, flown all over the place, and ends up 23 days later in, you know, what we now know to be a black site, under this program of extraordinary rendition, where he's basically, as he alleges it, tortured for 4 months, at which point the CIA goes, whoops, wrong guy and just sort of dumps him you know, in a field somewhere and hopes for the best. So the reason this sort of rises to a sort of referendum on executive power is because perhaps not unreasonably, al-Masri seeks justice in the American court system, and he December of 2005, he sued George Tenet and the CIA agents involved, and the government essentially, in response, shut down the lawsuit, claiming that there is this state secret doctrine, which we don't really know very much about, but that there is this state secret doctrine which precludes not only details of his treatment to come into court, but the entire lawsuit must be dismissed. And he prevailed, Warren, in the lower federal court, in the Court of Appeals. The administration prevailed and basically said, you're right, the state secret doctrine is so fundamental and so crucial that al-Masri essentially cannot have his day in court.
And, of course, the government can't avoid the problem of, which one assumes it is invoking here, of releasing information it doesn't want to release by slipping him some money, just settling the case or something. That, I suppose, would be admitting to his accusations.
Right. Now, I mean, one of the things that is most interesting here is that we've never litigated the questions of his accusations because the courthouse door was barred to him before we could even sort of have any evidence introduced on how he was treated, you know, why he was treated the way he was. As I said, you know, the courthouse door was locked, and he was essentially told, "Go home. There's no day in court for you, sir," because the whole extraordinary rendition program, the way we detain and interrogate suspected terrorists, all of it is a secret. And, you know, as al-Masri's lawyers have pointed out, how can it be a secret? I've shouted it from the rooftops. You know, everybody knows about this. It's in all the European papers. It's in all the American papers. And still, the claim that this treatment is a secret, in itself a secret, that bars litigation, has really prevailed. And you know, the court failing to hear it today has essentially sort of let that Fourth Circuit decision stand that says, yep, you can't even come into court, sir.
So this would suggest then a precedent? That is the court likely to do this again if somebody else comes up with similar kinds of charges involving extraordinary rendition?
Well, there are other cases burbling up through the system, and certainly you know, the court has another one to look at that comes out of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals that may be more appealing to the Supreme Court because it involves the claims of American citizens and not German citizens, and perhaps that will make a difference. So certainly this has no precedential value in that, you know, no law was made today. But it is sort of an interesting, I think, test case in terms of, you know, the conduct that is alleged here is so unconscionable and so shocking. And still, you know, the court wasn't prepared to hear it. So, you know, now the state secrets doctrine has been used by the Bush administration. You know, this is an interesting doctrine. It dates back to the Cold War, to the 1950s. You know, research shows that it had only been used six times between 1953 and 1976. It's been used 39 times by the Bush administration since 2001, and they use it to block everything from lawsuits about the NSA surveillance program to lawsuits by whistleblowers to two lawsuits involving torture. So it's become this sort of interesting catch-all defense for the Bush administration that says, whatever it is you're alleging we've done wrong, we don't even have to go to court because it's a secret. So, you know, this is an incredibly important issue that the Supreme Court should touch. I will say that the courts have tended to be very, very deferential in these cases, very willing to sort of accede to the Bush administration argument that, you know, you don't want to go here. You don't want to look at these things because this is sort of the province of the president's war-making powers.
We got about 30 seconds left. What has this done in terms of U.S. relations with Germany? This was a German citizen involved.
Yeah, I mean, this is a real problem. And, you know, Angela Merkel has said, you know, she heard from Condoleezza Rice herself that al-Masri was a, quote, mistake. And so the fact that this mistake cannot be rectified in any American courts sends out a terrible message, not just to Germany, but to all of our allies, that, you know, in effect, whoops, is a defense now.
I misread the clock. We've got another minute. Angela Merkel raised this issue with Condoleezza Rice. Did Condoleezza Rice have anything to say about it?
Yeah, I mean, she said, whoops, this disappearance and protracted detention really was, quote, a mistake. And yet, we just don't take accountability for our mistakes anymore, and that has to be sort of molar-grindingly frustrated.
She did acknowledge that these things happen.
Well, she didn't acknowledge the details, and indeed, you know, nobody's willing to acknowledge the details. George Tenet himself has said, I just don't agree with El Masri's account of things. But, you know, I don't agree isn't a legal defense. These things are supposed to get, you know, hashed out in court. And so we now have this funny situation where El Masri's allegations, which, by the way, have been backed up by an official German inquiry, and other eyewitnesses, all of these folks who back up his version of the story, is somehow being trumped by the assertion by Tenet that I don't agree.
Now we really are out of time. Dahlia Lithwick, really always good to have you with us.
Thank you, Warren.
Senior editor, legal correspondent, Slate.com, a contributor to NPR's Day to Day program. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Dan Konecki and Karina Miller, technical director Mike Newport. For more information about To the Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point. Produced live and podcast is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.